CFAX 1070.
Good morning, everyone. Great to have you with us. Welcome to Legally Speaking with Michael Mulligan of Mulligan, Tam, and Pearson. How are you?
Very well, thank you. Good morning.
Exhaling after the election?
That's about it.
Yeah, I think everyone just... we've hit a bit of calm, but then, oh no, it's not calm at all. We have Senator Patrick Brazeau.
He's back.
Yeah.
He had, of course, during the election campaign, his ongoing at that time trial, which was originally for charges including a fairly serious sexual assault. During his trial, however, the Crown came to the conclusion that the complainant in that case simply wasn't credible after she testified and was cross-examined. And as a result of that conclusion that she simply wasn't credible in her allegation of sexual assault, Crown and defense agreed to enter guilty pleas to a charge of simple assault with respect to that person, not sexual assault, and as well a count of possession of cocaine. Now, what happened during the election campaign is that the Crown and defense made what's called a joint submission to the judge about what the judge should do in terms of the sentencing. And a joint submission would be, I guess, what it sounds like. Both the Crown prosecutor and defense counsel both asked the judge to impose what's referred to as a discharge rather than a sentence, like a jail sentence or a fine or probation or something of that sort. The judge took some time to consider, believe it's his position on the matter, and then just yesterday finally gave his decision and did do what both lawyers had asked him to do and granted Senator Brazeau what's called an absolute discharge.
Why would the Crown cozy up with the defense on that? Ask for the same thing.
That's a good question. I mean, the Crown's job isn't to seek the maximum possible penalty. The Crown's job in a prosecution is to push the evidence to its reasonable limit, but ultimately to take a position which would be fair. That's really what the Crown should be doing. There's a classic case that talks about the role of Crown Counsel. And that role is described as being a sort of small M minister of justice. So when somebody's acting as Crown in a case, their position shouldn't be to try to seek the maximum possible penalty. They should do what, in their judgment, is fair.
So they agreed that that was fair.
They agreed that was fair. Now, there are two kinds of discharges in Canada. One's called an absolute discharge, and the other kind is called a conditional discharge. A conditional discharge is associated with a period of probation, and then if you successfully complete the probation, at that point, with a conditional discharge, you would be discharged and deemed not to have been convicted of the offense, which is important from a point of view of traveling or employment or,
sure,
in this case, whether Senator Brazeau would continue to be Senator Brazeau or not.
Do you still have it on your record?
That's an excellent question. Sometimes people use the term criminal record, which isn't a term of art, but we have in Canada a database called CPIC, which is maintained by the RCMP in Ottawa, and it would list on it any criminal convictions. If a person receives a discharge after a period of time, sort of just an admit by administrative process, the fact of the discharge no longer shows up on the CPIC database. So if a person was then, for example, that's the database which Canada would share with, for example, U.S. immigration authorities. Mm. So after a period of time, it wouldn't show up, and the person wouldn't have a problem getting into the United States. Now, Senator Brazeau received something one better than a conditional discharge. He received what's called an absolute discharge. And an absolute discharge is one which occurs immediately. The person doesn't need to serve a period of probation before they would be discharged. And in this case, there would be a number of things which might explain why that would be so, why this was imposed rather than a conviction. And they would probably include the fact that the other charges were outstanding for a period of 2 years already. So there would have been a period of time to observe, you know, how did he do on judicial interim release? Did he get into other trouble for the past 2 years?
So they're able to use that as evidence of... Well, I mean, instead of a conditional?
Yeah. I mean, a judge is permitted, and the Crown would be permitted, to take into account the other mm-hmm. consequences that something has already had. You know, he's been suspended from his job as a senator, lost pay, been publicly humiliated, was originally charged with sexual assault, and ultimately concluded that the complainant simply wasn't credible in those allegations. So the things which would have gone into this would be right. somebody who's suffered in a serious way for 2 years, those other consequences, and that would have played into why perhaps a discharge at all or a absolute discharge would be appropriate. The test for a discharge is whether a judge is persuaded that a discharge would be in the interest of the accused person, which that's usually not much of a hurdle, but more significantly, whether it would be contrary to the public interest to grant somebody a discharge. You know, is this somebody who we need to mark with a criminal record so we, you know, people could be aware of them, or this sort of thing?
Would that not take precedence over the individuals?
They need to meet both criteria.
Okay. So equally.
Equally. The first one, the person's best interest, that might not apply if, for example, you already had a conviction for something. Because what difference does it make if a person already had a drug conviction for cocaine the month before? Well, you might have a hard time getting to the point where you could persuade somebody that somehow a discharge now would be in their interest. Mm. What difference does it make? It's already, that ship has sailed. So that's what happened. And the judge took time to consider whether to do what they were being asked to do. And that's because judges aren't bound by a joint submission, even where the Crown and the defense agree. A judge ultimately has that responsibility. With that being said, they would not ordinarily depart from a position the Crown and the defense agree upon unless they concluded that it would be sort of inappropriate, depending mm-hmm. on how exactly that test is articulated. But in this case, the judge took time, considered all of the circumstances, including what the original charge was and what this person had been through, and concluded this was appropriate.
Absolute discharge. Can he be a senator?
Well, it's the way it works in Canada is if you're a senator, you're a senator until you're 75 or you get disqualified for some reason. The language in the Constitution Act is that if you're convicted of treason or convicted of a felony, that's a bit out of date, the language, or an infamous crime, you could be removed. You can also be removed if you miss two consecutive sessions of Parliament. So if you went to jail, even if your crime wasn't deemed infamous, you could also be removed just by not showing up. At one point, there was a senator, I think, who was living in Mexico and showed up once a year for one day. I think there was a mariachi band or something which was assembled to greet him on one occasion. So you've got to turn up and don't get convicted of an infamous crime. Otherwise, you're good to go until you're 75 if you get yourself that Senate appointment.
So Patrick Brazeau.
Patrick Brazeau. He may be back. He still has other charges, like Senator Duffy and Wallen and so on. He's got charges related to allegations of improperly claiming housing expenses, or whether the house he claimed to be living in was, in fact, his principal residence, so he could get these fees. And at the moment, I think his status is that his salary is being used to pay back the $50,000 they allege that wasn't due to him. So if he's convicted of that, I suppose then there would be some assessment as to whether that was an infamous crime.
Well, that's just it. What do we, you know, Brazeau's not infamous?
Well, it's got to be an infamous crime. And that decision, interestingly, would be, I suppose, at the first blush up to the senators themselves. There would be a vote. Senators can also suspend
one of them. In the heavily conservative-stocked Senate.
Yeah, that's true, although Patrick Brazeau indicated he voted Liberal in the last election, so I'm not sure where that puts him.
He might wish that he hadn't said that.
So there he is. He's one step closer to being back, and he's apparently the youngest senator, so we may be seeing him. He's saying he's going to sit as an independent going forward. That's also an interesting thing. Justin Trudeau, when in opposition, essentially dismissed all of the Liberal senators from the Liberal caucus. So they're all describing themselves as independent Liberals. So it's going to be an interesting time in the Senate. Legislation has to pass there, and you've also got all these vacancies. So Trudeau is going to have to deal with what to do. He's got a minority in the Senate at the moment of these independent liberals. It's a majority conservative, but there are these 20-plus vacancies. And there's even a court case going on now about whether it's a constitutional requirement to appoint people. So the language in the Constitution is shall appoint. So there's even some question about is it permissible to just leave seats vacant. But something's got to go on. And there is some discussion that Trudeau may try to use a more transparent appointment process to find people that have some objective merit rather than just, you know, picking people for political purposes. So hopefully that ups the game.
It's a very dry humor you have. Yes. some people that actually deserve to be in the Senate for other reasons. Okay, when we come back, more on Legally Speaking with Michael Mulligan of Mulligan, Tam, and Pearson. Stay with us.
Call us 250-386-1161 or on your cell at Star 1070. Pamela McCall on CFAX 1070. If it's the Callwood Crawl or a mess on the Malahat, we've got your back with more traffic more often. If it's happening, it's here. Victoria's News Authority, CFAX 1070.
Bull and Books at Hillside Center, bringing you the best books from around the world. This year, celebrating 40 years as Victoria's community bookstore. This week at Bull and Books.
The third gripping installment in Robert Galbraith's Cormoran Strike series, Career of Evil, is on sale now. This is one of the most highly anticipated new mystery novels of the year. Don't miss it.
Bull and Books, Victoria's community bookstore in Hillside Center. Call the Bull and Book line at 595-READ.
Island Bakery presents another slice of life.
Baking bread is like a personal journey through a fine, productive day. We begin by rising. We work with our hands. We shape our lives. We know that even when the heat is on, some good will come of it. And finally, we take a slice of what we did and we feed our dreams for the next day. Bread, like the challenge of a new day, is the sustenance of life.
Island Bakery, from their family to yours, delivered fresh daily.
I'm BC's Minister of State for Emergency Preparedness, Naomi Yamamoto, inviting you to learn not to burn. It's a free fire safety program designed for Canadian kids.
I played fire safety games with my mom and dad at safeathome.ca. I learned about the smoke alarm beep-beep noise and what to do when I hear it. I helped draw our home fire escape plan, too.
Choose tamper-proof smoke alarms with 10-year batteries to help keep your children safe. Visit safeathome.ca.
The Acura Performance Event is on now at Campus Acura. Your chance to save big on the premier luxury SUV available today. The 2016 Acura MDX, featuring 7-passenger seating, dual-eye LED headlights, super handling all-wheel drive, Acura Watch driver assist features, power tailgate, and more. The 2016 Acura MDX, yours for $568 a month with $5,540 down and 0.9% financing. Or get up to $5,000 cash rebate, but only at Campus Acura. 3347 Oak Street, online at CampusAcura.com.
Well, we have a report of a stall on the bridge, and bad news, folks. He's called BCAA. Poor guy, he's in for a long wait.
BCAA has locked out its emergency road service dispatchers. That means you may have a long wait if you break down, no matter how many people are stuck in traffic behind you. Call 1-800-811-5900 to tell BCAA to negotiate a fair deal and end the lockout now. Brought to you by COPE 378.
I don't work within the same rules as traditional law enforcement.
Shelley Stone is vice president.
Shut the front door.
With a lethal weapon she didn't know existed.
What exactly have I found?
The greatest secret in the history of our country.
This fall on Bravo.
John Case at your service, Madam Vice President.
No kidding.
No kidding.
The secret is out.
Impressive.
Sharon Stone stars in Agent X. Premieres November 10 at 7. Only on Bravo.
Living life to the fullest. Lifestyle with Patty Mack. Saturdays at 1 on CFAX 1070. The biggest news events. The stories in our community. Understood. It's Pamela McCall on CFAX 1070.
Welcome back, everybody. It's Legally Speaking with Michael Mulligan of Mulligan, Tam, and Pearson. We're going to move on now to what's known as police carding and why Ontario is proposing a ban. What is carding?
Carding would also sometimes be referred to as a street check by the police. And what it amounts to is the police deciding by whatever criteria to go up and check somebody's ID and ask them sort of what they're doing and what their business is when they're not a suspect in any particular crime. So approaching somebody and saying, yes, sir, please come over here. May I see your ID? Where are you going? What's your address? So why are you out at this time at night? This sort of thing. And then often that data would get entered into the police computer system. You know, things like, you know, this person's associated with this other person over here, what their address is, where they're living, what their stated reason for being out at that time of day was, this sort of thing. And that has been a... practice would go on with some frequency. It became a issue in Toronto and in Ontario, in part because it was the Toronto Star back there got some data that showed how that was being done in a concrete way. And it showed, for example, that if you were black, you were three times more likely than somebody who was white to be stopped and processed by the police in this way when they weren't investigating somebody for any criminal offense or any offense. And it raises some interesting issues because we you have a right to be free from arbitrary arbitrary searches by the police. There's a constitutional obligation upon arrest or detention to tell you why somebody has done that to you. And what's being proposed in Ontario are some regulations that would restrain further how the police could conduct these sort of carding street check stops in order to try to get away from things like race-based profiling and stopping black men in Toronto to ask for their papers
as
they walk down the road.
Michael, what about just stopping anybody in general if there's nothing untoward? Can police just stop you just for the heck of it and say, produce your ID?
Well,
be it Ontario or BC, streets of Victoria right now.
There are a few different levels that question can be answered on. On one level, you've got people with guns and nightsticks, and if the armed person tells you to stop and produce your ID, it's going to be the bold, confident, or well-informed person who says, you know, am I under arrest? Why are you asking for that? And chooses to walk away. And how the police officer responds to that, there's a legal answer to what they should be doing, depending on the circumstance, and then there's a practical one.
Well, don't they have to tell you why they're asking you for your ID?
Well, it depends on what you're doing and why they've stopped you. And that's one of the reasons it can be challenging for a citizen faced with that sort of a request from the police. There are some so if you're walking down the road and the police can simply come up to you and say, you know, show me your ID, the starting point would be you're not obliged to be producing that, but if the police, for example, have reasonable grounds to believe you've committed an offense, they're permitted to arrest you, at which point you would have an obligation to provide ID.
But at that point, though, wouldn't they say, we'd like to see your ID because X, Y, and Z?
Yes. I mean, it should be started with, you're under arrest, you know, what is your name, and may I see some ID?
So what's going on in Ontario that differs from what we just spoke of here?
They're not arresting these people. They're not the people that are being carded or subject to a street check aren't under arrest for anything. The police have just decided to stop and shake them down. May I see your ID? What's your name? Where are you going to? Who's this person you're with? Mm. Why are you out at this time? Or you'll see other things like, what's in your pocket? Let's have a look in there. Any drugs in that pocket?
So presumably that could go on in the streets of Victoria.
It would. That's not going to be an uncommon interaction. Now, what they're doing in Ontario is that they're, by regulation, going to require police officers, when they do that sort of a check, when they're not arresting somebody, they're not engaged in some person's not engaged in some regulated activity like driving, for example. If you're driving, the police are permitted to stop you, even without a reason to believe you've committed any offense, to check to make sure you've got a driver's license, that you have insurance. That you're not impaired, they're permitted
sure,
to do that.
Because you're doing something, yeah.
That's a regulated activity.
Right.
Otherwise, you could drive around with impunity with no license and no insurance if you didn't commit a moving violation. Not acceptable.
No.
So in Ontario, what they're proposing is that if a police officer stopped you in this way for a street check or carding, they would be required to tell you that you've got a right to walk away. They would be required to tell you that interacting with them is voluntary. And that part's true. I mean, the police can approach you like the mailman can approach you and say, hi there, what's your name and where are you going? And now with the mailman, most people would feel free to say, none of your business. But you probably wouldn't feel that way with a police officer.
Coal in your mailbox.
They would also be required to tell you that you don't have to do those things. And they would also be required to do things like file a report indicating who they stopped, why they stopped them, this sort of thing.
Which so they don't have to do now?
They don't have to do that. But what happens now, this is the other issue, is when people are stopped in that way, the police will frequently enter information they obtain from them into a database that they have future access to. Who they stopped, who they were with, what their address was, what they were doing, enter that in. And that then if you have some future interaction with the police, that will come up. Now, at one point, we all had a bit of anonymity by virtue of the difficulty of storing paper. You could only keep so many paper records about dealing with somebody, at which point it became unmanageable. Now, in the age of computers and databases, that sort of anonymity doesn't exist for practical reasons. So, if you phone the police today and say, my barbecue is stolen, they'll say, what's your name? Where do you live? We'll enter that in. If you phone them back in a year and said, my bicycle was stolen, they put your name in and say, oh, yes, I see your barbecue got stolen. Did you ever get that back?
Mm.
The same would hold true with the sort of data that would be collected on these street check stops.
Regardless of whether you've done something or not.
That's right. And while there would be theoretical legal remedies for some of that, right? You've got a right to be free from, for example, arbitrary searches. So if the police stop somebody at random on the street and say, turn out your pocket, sir, what do you have in there? They don't have any legal authority to do that. That would be an arbitrary search.
But then it's incumbent upon the person who's turned out their pockets to get a lawyer and say, I was mistreated? Or
yeah, and good luck. You know, that's just not likely to happen. Is the street person who gets stopped by the police and told, turn out your pockets and give me your ID, is that person likely to hire a lawyer and go to the superior court and seek a remedy for the breach of their constitutional rights? Not likely. And what they have in mind in Ontario is to make it something which the police officer could be individually disciplined for. So the idea would be if you had police doing these sort of stops, particularly ones which would be racially profiling ones, and they weren't advising people that they didn't have to talk to them and weren't filing reports and doing the things they have to do, the individual police officer there would be subject to discipline. So you could have a person make a complaint and the chief of police could deal with it rather than telling somebody go hire a lawyer and go to Supreme Court and seek a remedy for the police telling you to turn out your pockets.
So the onus is on the police instead of on the individuals they're stopping.
Yeah, it would create something where it could be dealt with in an administrative way by the sort of the police hierarchy rather than requiring somebody to go make a court application. And you would also expect police to generally comply with the law. If there's
yeah.
a specific requirement to tell people they have the right to walk away, you would hope they do that.
Well, and yeah, they're not going to want to get themselves in hot water. One to watch for sure. Fascinating stuff. I sure appreciate all of your insight into the latest news from a legal perspective, Michael.
Thank you.
All the best. We've been talking to